Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Biography. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm talking with Charlotte DeCruz Jacobs about her biography of the 20th century medical researcher Jonas Salk. Charlotte, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
I'm a professor of medicine at Stanford University. I grew up in Northeast Tennessee, and at that time, as a child, or I guess as a grade school student, I was struck by two things. One, I saw a movie at our local kids club called The Microbe Hunters. And after seeing that movie at, I think, about the age of six, I decided I wanted to be a doctor, and there was no dissuading me, even though at that period in time, I would say about 90% of women in the United States were housewives. And the second thing is that during my grade school years, my favorite thing to read was biography. And we had a whole collection of the Bob Smerrill children's biographies, and I made sure that I read every single one, some twice. I graduated from Washington University School of Medicine and trained at Stanford University in cancer, and I have spent my entire career there. I've mostly done patient care, research, teaching. I've been the dean for student education and the director of the Clinical Cancer Center. And right now, I still work predominantly taking care of veterans with cancer. That's how I wanted to end my medical career. Midway through my career, I had a sabbatical, and I spent it studying creative writing and then biography writing. My first biography is entitled Henry Kaplan and the Story of Hodgkin's Disease. It was published by Stanford University Press in 2010. And Henry Kaplan, who's not a household name, certainly is in the world of cancer. He's a esteemed and very controversial physician scientist who really changed the course of cancer therapy. He developed the linear accelerator, which is the machine used to deliver radiation today. And he was responsible for the cure of a disease called Hodgkin's disease, which is a cancer of predominantly young adults. When I finished with that, I loved the process of writing biography, and I spent another year trying to determine who I wanted to spend my next 10 years with. And there was no question but that it would be Jonas Salk. Now, there's a little bit of a personal reason, and that is he was, I think, the greatest hero of my generation when he made the polio vaccine. And in 1954, polio was rampant. It really cast a shadow over every summer. It was called the summer plague. And it came almost every May, leaving at Labor Day, leaving thousands of kids maimed or dead. In the summer, swimming pools were closed, theaters were closed, birthday parties canceled as parents tried to protect their children. But there was really little they could do because it's a highly infectious disease, which then goes on to be crippling. In 1954, my town, Kingsport, Tennessee, was selected as a trial site for the test of Jonas Salk's polio vaccine that was funded and conducted by the March of Dimes. Every child knew about the March of Dimes. We all collected dimes for it. And I was a second grader at the time and participated in the trial. So I was very proud to be called a polio pioneer. And a year later, when it was announced that his vaccine was a success, that polio could be conquered, as I say, he became one of the greatest heroes of my generation.
That's one of the things I noticed as I was reading your book, is that it's not just about Jonas Salk's life, but you're also describing how he becomes this iconic figure in not just American culture, but really in the world, as this person who has, you know, done this remarkable thing in defeating this disease with his vaccine.
That's true. He was, for years, actually, as people give their top 10 lists of people that they most admire, he was in that top 10 list along with, you know, Churchill, Roosevelt, on and on. So he was Martin Luther King. He was always considered an icon throughout his life, which really became almost like an albatross, the proverbial albatross around his neck, as we'll talk about later.
One of the things I thought was interesting was how he attains this stature as this great, respected scientific figure, and his beginnings could not possibly be more humble. I was wondering if you could explain a bit where he comes from and how it was that he decided to embark upon a career in medicine.
Okay. Well, he was born on October 28th in 1914, and he was born in East Harlem. His mother told him he was born with a caul, C-A-U-L, that thin amniotic membrane covering his face. That meant that he was destined for greatness. And that was pretty unlikely because he was shy, he was submissive, a first-generation Jewish immigrant, and he was most comfortable with his books rather than with other children. But he believed his mother, and his brothers told me that he used to pray daily that one day he would perform a noble deed. So he worked very, very hard. He was accepted into Townsend Harris High School in New York City, which was a select high school that he had to take a test to get into, and then went to City College to get a free education, as many immigrants did at the time. He was accepted into New York University Medical School. At the time, it was very hard for Jewish young men and women to get accepted into medicine. The quota system was in effect. But he stood out a little bit because when they asked him about a career in medicine, he did not want to just practice medicine and make a living. He wanted to change medicine and do research. And that was not a common thing at that time for medical school graduates. So he was accepted into New York University and then trained at Mount Sinai Hospital. And during this time, he met and did some research with a very esteemed virologist named Thomas Francis. And that later became the key to his very first major research accomplishment with influenza.
His mother looms very large in as a figure who not just was very influential in terms of Salk's childhood, but seemed to be a very he seemed to cast a long shadow over the course of his life. I was wondering if you could explain just briefly a bit about her and her role in terms of shaping young Jonas.
Yeah. Well, she was, in many ways, and I hate to use this term, kind of the classic Jewish mother, but immigrant mother, probably, who had come from an immigrant family and wanted her children to succeed. She married a very lovely man, his father, who was a lace maker, but nowhere near as prominent in Jonas's life as she was. Jonas is her oldest. She spent a considerable amount of time with him and helping him plan his career. Interestingly, early on when he was in high school, he very much wanted to be a lawyer. He always wanted to help the underdog. That was something that it was very prominent. And his mother said, no, he could not be a lawyer because he couldn't even win an argument with him. She thought that, so then he said, well, he'd like to be a doctor. And she said, well, he didn't really have the stamina. He was a very small, thin child to be a doctor, but a teacher. He should be a teacher. He said the first time he defied his mother in his entire life was when he applied to medical school. But she was very proud of him and very supportive of his career. A lot of immigrant children, particularly Jewish immigrant kids, look to the pushing of their mother or their father, but predominantly the mother, as very difficult, something they had to kind of fight against. But he respected his mother so much and really bowed to a lot of her demands because he wanted to. So she was a very important person in his life. And his brothers, he had two younger brothers, they referred to Mr. and Mrs. Salk as the general and the duchess or something like that.
So he begins this job with Thomas Francis, and I was wondering if you could explain exactly what Francis, a bit more about him and what it was he was doing, and also, because this plays a role in their lives, when it was that this was taking place.
Okay. So Thomas Francis was a virologist. The field of virology was relatively new at that time, and almost everybody that was anybody in virology had been trained at the Rockefeller Institute. Thomas Francis was one of the first people to identify influenza virus. It wasn't really known before, and that there were multiple strains, and that those strains constantly changed, so that there'd be different strains every year of the virus. So Salk had done some research with him on the viruses when he was in medical school, and right after he finished his medical school training, he wanted to go and work with Francis, who was now at the University of Michigan, and kept writing letters to him. And Francis would reply, "Well, we don't really have any funds." And Salk would say, "Well, I'll come and work for nothing." And they went back and forth and back and forth. But suddenly, Pearl Harbor was bombed. And when the U.S. entered the war, an influenza epidemic threatened the troops. And this brought back, there had been lots of flu epidemics, but this really brought back memories of the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic, which killed millions and millions around the world, but predominantly killed young men. And almost as many young men died of this influenza as died in the war. So Salk suddenly wrote to Francis and said, "I'm on my way. I'm moving to Ann Arbor to help you make an influenza vaccine." And Francis was kind of taken aback, but it turned out that Salk worked very, very hard and helped him constitute the first influenza vaccine. And then Francis was busy with going around the world looking at potential sites of epidemics. And so Salk really did most of the trials to prove the efficacy of the influenza vaccine. But Francis received. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
But Francis received most of the accolades for it, because he was a well-known person, and Jonas Salk was just a kind of a young whippersnapper. So he felt pretty stymied by this, and he went ahead and took a position at the University of Pittsburgh, and there he set out. This is Salk, set out to make what he called a universal influenza vaccine, way ahead of his time. He was coming up with a way to add multiple strains to one vaccine, so that it would affect year after year. But as usual, he was blocked by many of the senior scientists in the field, became very discouraged about it.
One of the things that you describe in terms of this point in his life is the context. You mentioned the discouragement that he received from some senior colleagues, but it was also interesting to read about the conditions in which he worked, about how basically it's not just about Salk's life, but you're getting a sense as to what medical science was like at that time. And I was wondering if you could perhaps elaborate about that a bit, as it might inform a little later in our interview, how it shaped how they tested out the polio vaccine, especially Salk in 53 and 54, when he's first pioneering this vaccine and testing out to see if it has any effectiveness.
Well, he, maybe I should say the transition, how he got into polio. So first off, when he moved to the University of Pittsburgh with the idea in mind of working on an influenza vaccine, and he had negotiated with them, he got there and found out that he had this tiny laboratory space that was in the prior morgue at the University of Pittsburgh in the basement. So they had kind of, you know, in a sense, he thought they'd kind of swindled him. And he spent a lot of time. He was really a go-getter, but in a very nice way. He was a very retiring personality. But he continued to work very nicely with the public health leader at the local hospital and with the university, and bit by bit got himself a fairly large laboratory. There was no such thing really as good governmental funding at that period in time. So he constantly was looking for money to do his research. So in 1947, Harry Weaver, who was the research director for the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, which became better known as the March of Dimes later on, he had his eye on this young go-getter and asked him to join their effort against polio, staying at the University of Pittsburgh and doing research there for polio. And, of course, with it came money. So Jonas Salk said, sure, sure, he'd do that, keeping in mind that he'd kind of do that on the side and continue his influenza research. But once he became engaged in polio research, he became passionate about making a polio vaccine. Eventually that took over all of his research, and he didn't get back to influenza until much later in his life.
The state of polio research was very, what was another part that you describe in the book. It's interesting to see him as a relatively junior figure in this hierarchy that he's in. And how, could you perhaps explain that a bit and how that influences his subsequent efforts to get them to adopt his vaccine?
Well, at that period in time, I'll just mention about the vaccines first. Really, the three major vaccines were the smallpox, diphtheria, and rabies. And those were all vaccines that were made with a live virus. And the virus had been weakened, so it wouldn't cause a full-blown disease, but it was weakened such that the body developed a really minor form of the disease, and then you built up resistance by forming antibodies, and you would have resistance for life. And so the old story of Edward Jenner, who was a country doctor and found that cowpox, he could take some of the virus from the cowpox, which was the same as smallpox, but very, very weakened, and vaccinate people, he could prevent smallpox. So that was the that was kind of the dogma. That was how everyone felt that you should approach polio, with a live, weakened virus. Now, most of the polio researchers at that period in time, as I mentioned, were trained at the Rockefeller Institute. There was, I don't know if medicine's changed today, but there was a very kind of elite group of scientists. And you really had to be kind of part of the scientific brotherhood, a member of the various academies, and there was a pecking order, so that when Basil O'Connor, who was the very powerful director of the March of Dimes or the National Foundation, wanted advice on how to approach polio, he formed a committee of these very top leaders in polio research. And Albert Sabin, who's a major person in this book, was one of the leaders and probably one of the most outspoken on this committee that was going to advise the National Foundation how to approach polio. Well, Jonas Salk, here's this young guy, you know, just barely out of training, kind of wet behind his ears, and not really accepted in the scientific community, even though he had helped co-develop this influenza vaccine. Everyone thought, well, it was really Thomas Francis. And so they gave him a lot of kind of menial tasks to do as this group was planning exactly how they were going to proceed to make a live polio vaccine. Well, Salk was, you know, a very nice person. Sure, he said he'd try to find out how many different types of polio virus there were, and undertook what's called a typing project, and found there were three. And that's very important, because if there are three different strains, then you have to cover them all in a vaccine. So that kind of gave him an opening into the world of polio research. But they were continuing to assign him what he would do, and they had a certain timeline and plans, this powerful committee. But in 1952, 57,000 Americans contracted polio. And Salk was a human scientist. He was a scientist, but he cared deeply about the public. And he didn't want to stand in line behind this cadre of senior scientists waiting to make a live virus vaccine on their timeline. So he had a very different agenda, but he didn't tip his hand. He only Basil O'Connor and Harry Weaver were privy and actually supported him in his work, which was all done really behind the backs of this powerful committee who was determining the role and the process of making a polio vaccine.
So how exactly does Salk go about demonstrating the efficacy of this vaccine that he's developing? Yeah. And what distinguishes it from the main effort to do the live virus that Sabin and others are focusing on?
So, in fact, I think there are two aspects of his vaccine work that were really remarkable. And the first was that he did make a vaccine from a killed virus. And he had learned that technique. Interestingly, influenza was a killed virus vaccine. It had to be because the strains kept changing every year. But it's a very kind of different disease. So he did make this vaccine from a killed virus when their prevailing dogma was that you could only obtain lifelong protection with a vaccine with a live weakened virus, as had been the case in smallpox, diphtheria, and rabies. The second remarkable thing about him is he just had a handful of laboratory assistants. He wasn't some large research institute or large pharmaceutical company. He was at University of Pittsburgh, which was kind of an undistinguished medical school at the time. He and his group made the first polio vaccine in 3 months. 3 months. That's just amazing when you think of how long it takes to make things in this day and age and all the requirements from the government. And then he proceeded to conduct his vaccine trial in secret at the Watson Home for Crippled Children, which was in Leedsville, Pennsylvania. And all he wanted to do was see if he could get antibody levels after he gave the vaccine. And so he gave every shot and drew every blood sample himself. He just hovered over the Watson Home for Crippled Children. And the parents and children and the staff were all sworn to secrecy so that this powerful committee nor did the press know this was going on. And one thing I thought was interesting is he said that when he looked back over the entire polio saga, that the highlight, the high point for him in that entire thing was when he measured anti-polio antibodies in the first child he vaccinated. He said at that moment in time, he knew he could prevent polio. So, and then he went on to test at another children's home. So this committee had no idea. No one knew this was going on except for Basil O'Connor and Harry Weaver. So finally, he did have to disclose his work to this powerful committee. And I had all the minutes from that meeting. It was amazing. They just kind of were stunned. I mean, they just couldn't believe he had done this in a negative sense. And they started interrogating him, and Sabin depicted his results really as implausible, humiliating Salk. And then kind of a melee erupted as the committee members took sides. Half of them said, no, we need to wait until we have a live virus vaccine, which was going to be several years. It takes much longer to develop a live virus vaccine. And those in favor of an immediate nationwide trial, because, you know, 57,000 people getting polio and the huge number dying and remaining crippled. So the committee was in gridlock. And so Weaver just did a very smart thing. He just appointed a new committee called the Vaccine Advisory Committee, and it was composed of healthcare leaders who favored an immediate large randomized trial. And so that was great. But Salk was not to have anything to do with the trial.
You go on to describe what you call the world's largest clinical trial, and it really does Yeah, it's one of my favorite chapters because you do a great job of capturing just how epic this was, this idea of this nation coming together, the sense of anticipation about knowing how it turns out, you also chronicle how they're racing against time. Because of it, they're making mistakes and they're having to resolve differences, deeply seated differences, and they're having to do it on the fly as they're busy trying to throw all this together. Because again, that you know, every day they wait is a day in which there might be another person coming down with polio.
That's exactly right. So it was before the trial began, which was a big national trial that was supported by the March of Dimes. Weaver told Salk he couldn't do the trial because it would be considered suspect if he tested his own vaccine. So he turned the trial's design and analysis over to Thomas Francis. But Thomas Francis would do it just on the proviso that he would give no results prematurely, not even to Basil O'Connor or to Jonas Salk. So for a full year, Salk kind of stood on the sidelines and watched as this saga, as you say, took place. So several pharmaceutical companies began large-scale production, and some of them took shortcuts, which he was worried would reduce its safety. And then the Laboratory of Biologic Control in Washington began dictating changes in his vaccine, and he thought that might impair its efficacy. And then here they are trying to rush and get the vaccine out before the next polio season, which starts in May or June. And one thing after another happened. One of the pharmaceutical companies had vaccine that was tainted with a potentially dangerous live virus. And then there were rumors of kidney damage. And each time one of these happened, everything came to a grinding halt until they could resolve it. Then the major needle manufacturer went on strike. And then just as they were ready to start, Walter Winchell, who was a very popular radio commentator, warned the audience not to take the vaccine. He said it might be a killer. But despite all that, on April 26, 1954, what was the largest clinical trial in the history of American medicine started. And so the other thing that I think is just quite amazing that you allude to is this wasn't a trial that was run by professional research organization or the United States government. This was a trial that was run essentially by the March of Dimes with the money given by volunteers and across the United States. And as I say, when I was a child, you know, if you had a dime and you didn't know whether you're going to buy a bag of candy or put that dime in the March of Dimes box. it was bought into by people, you know, here I was 7 years old living in a little town in Tennessee, and it reached out to everyone. And so Basil O'Connor said the trial would be run by volunteers. And so on April 26 in 1954, a million first, second, and third graders in schools and clinics across the United States were assigned by random draw to either receive placebo or vaccine. And the people that it was almost like an army of volunteers that conducted the trial. There were, I think, 20,000 physicians and public health officials, 40,000 nurses, 14,000 school principals, 50,000 teachers, and 220,000 housewives. And the trial was run just, you know, there were a few flaws and flubs here and there where they'd get names mixed and things. But on the whole, it was run superbly and analyzed by Thomas Francis and his group with no premature information given to Salk. And in fact, on the day of the announcement, he was to speak right after Francis. And that morning at breakfast, Francis gave him the results of the trial.
You describe
really quite exciting time.
Oh, you describe your description is very melodramatic about how he, this very unmelodramatic person, Thomas Francis, gets up there and he gives results in a very clinical way, and he doesn't bother to you know make it accessible, but he's basically makes this incredibly important announcement, one that you know that millions of people throughout the world have been waiting to hear.
That's right. That 80 to 90% effective against paralytic polio, and not one child had been harmed by it. And the world, it really, because I was there, the celebration that erupted was enormous, with church bells were tolling and sirens ringing and people running out into the street crying and hugging each other, and polio's conquered with the headlines, you know, across the world. And many people did compare it to the celebration to the end of a war.
How was Salk affected by this news and the attention that the success of the polio vaccine now received?
Well, he never thought for one minute that it wouldn't be a success. If it wasn't a success, it would have been, he thought, because the formulation of his vaccine had been changed. So he always said that he was confident, but what he didn't anticipate was what followed. And Edward R. Murrow, who had befriended him, said to him that day, "Young man, a great tragedy has just befallen you. You have lost your anonymity." And it didn't take Salk long. You know, he just thought he'd go home that day and then go back to the lab. But within a month, he, or the University of Pittsburgh on his behalf, got 10,000 letters, telegrams, phone calls. As he walked down the street, everyone came up to shake his hand. He couldn't go into a restaurant or hotel without causing a stir like a movie star. And, you know, he was really touched by this expression of gratitude, but he was suffocating. And then he saw the dark side of fame, the stalkers, obsessives, con artists. And years later, he told a New York Times writer, "It's as if I've been public property ever since. It's brought me," I'm quoting, "it's brought me enormous gratification, opened many opportunities, but at the same time placed many burdens on me. It altered my career, my relationships with colleagues. I'm a public figure, no longer one of them," which is kind of sad.
It reminds me of a line I once heard in a movie about how, you know, he doesn't care about fame, but fame sure cares about him now.
That's a great line. Although, you know, it's he liked a little bit of it, I think, even though he was an introvert, and he was honored by the public right and left. I mean, it was amazing the number of awards he received, and also the highest awards from heads of states, like Presidential Citation, the French Legion of Honor, the Nehru Award. But he really craved kind of recognition by the scientific community, and that he did not get. And that shocked me. That was one of the most surprising things I found out in my research. He got very few awards from the scientific community, very few. He was passed up by the Nobel Prize. Most people thought he won it, but the Nobel Committee concluded that his work wasn't, quote, prize-worthy. But probably more egregious, he was blackballed from the National Academy of Sciences, which is an organization started back in Lincoln, I think by President Lincoln, that recognizes the top physician scientists in the country. Here's a man who had just developed a vaccine that could prevent a crippling disease. He was blackballed, and some of the members said, "Well, it wasn't a true scientific discovery." One of them likened him to a director of product development at a pharmaceutical company. And Albert Sabin, who was the worst, said he described Salk's work as kitchen chemistry. He used to say, "Oh, anybody could go in the kitchen and do what he did." And of course,
he was in far behind when he comes out with his own virus vaccine just a few years later.
Yeah. But I think, you know, when I say Salk didn't like the fame, and it was like an albatross around his neck, he reached out, and I think this is part of the reason he was rejected by the scientific community or spun by them. He really reached out to the public in ways that very few physician scientists ever had in the history of medicine, except Louis Pasteur, I think. I mean, He gave interviews to Good Housekeeping and Parent Magazine. He went on television and showed the viewing audience how to make a vaccine with a wiring blender. I mean, no serious scientist should do that. And they accused him of kind of crossing this line of expected academic behavior and soliciting media attention. But I think with his success came a wave of celebrity that had been accorded few scientists in the history of medicine. And there was a little bit of jealousy, I think, there as well from the scientific community. It wasn't just about the fact that he did his research behind closed doors.
Did he try to do anything with that fame in terms of advancing other goals in his career?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And then we can come back to the fate of his polio vaccine, by the way, which is very, very important. But I think that allowed him to do a lot of things that he would not have otherwise been able to do. He always dreamed of forming an institute where scientists and humanists would work side by side, as he said, imbuing the sciences with the conscience of man, because he really was at heart a humanistic scientist, I guess is the best way to put it. And so he was able to get money from Basil O'Connor and others, and he built the Salk Institute in La Jolla, California, where he attracted some of the most prestigious or most accomplished scientists and humanists, and gave them total academic freedom and lifetime funding. And so he was able to build the Salk Institute. When he was through with his polio vaccine, he did want to return to his laboratory, and he was kind of vague in what he wanted to do. He said he was going to setting out to harness the immune system, which kind of the general public didn't understand what in the world he was talking about. But that meant he was going to study two disparate diseases, cancer, in which immunity had failed, and multiple sclerosis, in which an overactive immune system kind of destroys one's own immune nervous system tissue. And a lot of the funding for both of those came from the public, from private funds, from individuals, or from groups, as opposed to being funded by scientific organizations, so the National Cancer Institute, the National Institute of Health. He never wrote a successful grant, which is the normal way scientists get funding. So I think his fame certainly allowed him to do other endeavors that he never would have normally done. Or been funded to do, excuse me.
You also described the effect that his celebrity has on his personal life. He was married in the 1940s, and his wife Donna had raised his family, had been there for him. But you described, even with all the publicity, you're already seeing the signs of tension. What happened after that?
Well, just to go back, it wasn't just his wife. I mean, he had little time for his wife and three sons, and that's obvious from the way he worked day and night. The press used to have these pictures of him reading to his sons or preparing to fly a kite or enjoying a barbecue with his family, and those were all posed. They really rarely happened. His sons were sent off to the East to boarding schools. And they all told me that, kind of worse than having a legendary father or husband, that they became celebrities by association. So Peter Salk said, and Peter was just kind of a very shy, small child, but when he played Little League, if he got up to bat, everyone expected him to hit a home run because he was Peter Salk. And his wife, Donna, she was also very, very shy, and she could not really accommodate to the celebrity, and so they did get divorced. He, again, when you say, did his fame help him, I think it did help him in his next marriage, and that is subsequently he married a French artist, an accomplished French artist, Francoise Gillot, whose popular book, A Life with Picasso, detailed her years as Picasso's mistress. Now, she was considerably younger than he was. I think she was 48 and he was 55 when they got married in 1970. And she was beautiful. She was talented. She was beautiful. She was French. And Jonas Salk was very popular in France. She remembered her mother talking about this great Jonas Salk. And so they had been introduced by some of his friends in La Jolla. And they started dating, and he pursued her kind of with the same tenacity that he had pursued his polio vaccine. And when he proposed, she said, well, no, she couldn't marry him. There were too many issues. So they were having dinner in on the beach in La Jolla, California. And so he said to her, well, just make a list of requirements, and you'd marry me. And so he said, I'll go take a walk, and I'll come back. And so she made this whole list, and he looked over everyone. And I interviewed her, by the way. She was telling me this wonderful story. And he said, well, he could agree to every one. And one of those requirements was that they live together in La Jolla only 6 months a year, so that she could have 6 months by herself to paint and do her artwork in France. So they did marry, and she really, everyone kind of saw a transformation in his life because, you know, he was kind of a laboratory nerdy guy. Now he hiked, he sailed the Greek islands, he took French, he underwent Rolfing, learned yoga, joined a sensitivity group, and he now wore bell bottoms and open neck shirts with a neck scarf, and his hair grew out in long waves. And in fact, his sister-in-law told me that she called him Frenchified. And so people couldn't believe how happy he was. But as time went on, things started to get less and less wonderful. In fact, Gillot, when someone asked her how she ended up with two such venerable men, Picasso and Salk, she said, lions mate with lions, which kind of speaks to the kind of person she was. But the kind of the radiance of their relationship dimmed, and she spent more and more time in France. In fact, she said if it weren't for her husband, she wouldn't spend 5 minutes in La Jolla, California. So in the meantime, throughout both marriages, he did have affairs. And although she did not... Donna had died, his first wife, so I did not get to interview her, and Francois Gillot did not talk about that aspect of their lives, but and that certainly was problematic, but I think they kind of had an understanding among them, but they both could also have other aspects to their lives.
You also described, though, how his professional career in the 1970s was facing this growing setback with the Salk Institute, how he was, how he, some of the people he had drawn to it became a little condescending toward him, and more importantly, how he was gradually being squeezed out of the management of the Institute by the administrators that had come in.
Well, they all, you know, he attracted some amazing, amazing people. Francis Crick, Bronowski, who did The Ascent of Man. I mean, just incredible people. And there was this kind of love feast initially that it was going to be a Shangri-La for all of these people who could now think, and they didn't have to worry about grants, and they could all interact. And that kind of began to fall apart a little bit, and certainly kind of chasm between him and the other members of these distinguished scientists and humanists started widening pretty quickly. And part of it was that he insisted on running the Institute, and he was a terrible administrator and a really a bad communicator. And so the Institute was constantly kind of teetering on the edge of bankruptcy. And here these men had given up their laboratories and their academic positions at, you know, at Harvard and Yale and Oxford and everything to join him. But secondly, he still maintained a laboratory and used funding from the Salk Institute for his research in cancer and multiple sclerosis. And that research really was not top notch. And it began to become worrisome to the other members of the Institute that what would people think about the Institute when the kind of research coming out of his laboratory. And so they really kind of conspired to shut down his laboratory. He at one point said that he felt like a pariah in his own house. So although the and in the end, science really dominated the Institute. So even though the Salk Institute is fabulous, it's been a tremendous scientific success. But he thought it was one of his greatest, I wouldn't use the word failure because he never used the word failure, disappointments, I guess.
You described how it moved away from that initial vision of the merging of science and humanism to becoming much more of a conventional scientific research establishment. And that, in a sense, was reflecting sort of that transition away from what, you know, Salk being this, you know, presence to just being the name on the door.
Yeah. But it is an amazing place. I mean, it's beautiful. It was designed by Louis Kahn, and it overlooks the Pacific Ocean. And, you know, with Salk, walked through the Institute, and he was in love with it. He used to touch the walls. I mean, it was heaven. I mean, this kid that grew up in Harlem in the Bronx, and now he, you know, just looked out to the ocean and the sunsets, and he was transformed. He loved the Institute, and so it was really tragic for him that it turned out the way it did for him.
And yet that's not the last phase of his life. He experiences this and then he undertakes in the 1980s this remarkable challenge. I mean, he decides he's going to go and defeat AIDS.
Yep. So, you know, before I get to AIDS or either after, you tell me, I'd like to scroll back to what happened to the polio vaccine.
Well, why don't we go and talk about that first? Yes.
Okay. So 5 years after that polio trial, the incidence of polio had been reduced by 90% in the United States. But still, all the senior scientists said, nope, it's just a stopgap. It won't give total lifetime immunity. We need a live virus vaccine. And there was kind of a race among several scientists to develop one. And Albert Sabin rose to the top. And he tested his vaccine in Russia because everybody in the U.S. was starting to get the Salk vaccine and said it was effective and it was safe. And so, and it could be delivered in a sugar cube. So it was more convenient. It was more acceptable. It wasn't as costly because you didn't have needles and whatnot. And so in the early 60s, the Public Health Service recommended replacing Salk's vaccine with the Sabin vaccine. And there was a lot of kind of dirty politics that went on with that, too. Remember, Salk was not a favored person in the scientific community. And Salk was shocked that they would do this. I mean, he kept warning that, you know, a weakened live virus, yeah, it's weak, but it could revert to a more deadly virus and actually cause polio. And he went to every major medical association, every governmental agency, Congress, whatnot, trying to get people to see that this was a dangerous thing to do. And in a sense, he was like a lone crusader. You kind of wonder, where were people? All the scientists were backing the oral vaccine. And so by 1968, his vaccine was no longer produced in the United States. Kind of shocking. And he spent the rest of his life trying to reverse what he called this politically driven, risky decision.
And there were cases.
As time went on,
there were cases.
Yeah, there were cases. There were cases of people getting polio who got the Sabin vaccine. Now, Sabin said that was absolutely ludicrous. They'd probably already been exposed or they didn't really have polio or on and on. And Salk kept at it. I mean, it was just phenomenal how he kept over and over and over again pounding the different organizations and just getting people turning away from him and ignoring it. Finally, his vaccine, he then worked in France with the Merieux company and made a better, stronger polio vaccine with even better immunity and that it could be incorporated into the normal children's vaccine, so the diphtheria and the vaccine. and that children get in smallpox vaccine. And so it finally was finally his vaccine was reinstated, but he'd been dead for several years. So it was a huge saga that kind of went on and on from the day of the announcement. And I bring it up because it's very interesting. The polio has almost been extinguished from the world. I mean, that's amazing. And I get my polio weekly update, and the number of cases of polio, wild polio cases in 2016 was 37, and it was 16 this year. And the prediction is by 2019, there will be no wild polio virus circulating. But last year, there were 5 cases of polio from the Sabin vaccine, because the Sabin vaccine is used in some parts of the world where they can't give shots very well. And 80 cases this year, 80 cases of polio from the vaccine itself. And those were mostly in Syria and Pakistan and the Congo. So the organizations, the Global Polio Initiative, is Eradication Initiative, is trying to phase out the Sabin vaccine and only use the Salk vaccine.
One of the points that you make about that I thought was very interesting was that in spite of Salk's deep, passionate commitment to his vaccine and his deep, passionate opposition to Sabin's vaccine, he never made it personal. It was never quite a personal animosity for him towards Sabin.
No, it wasn't, but it was for Sabin to him. And so I spent a lot of time with Sabin's daughter, and she said, "Oh, Sabin used to say it was about humankind, but it was all about him. He used to say, 'I'm the one who has the polio vaccine.' And he thought that till the day he died." But Salk at one point said, "You know, this isn't about us two people. This is about two vaccines, and this is about how to get rid of polio. But I know someone's going to depict it as two little boys from the Bronx duking it out." So shall I tell you about AIDS quickly?
Please do.
I know. Okay. So Salk was kind of rolling down. The Salk Institute had faded, and he was writing philosophical books and whatnot and getting a little more kind of solitary. And suddenly the AIDS epidemic strikes. And in his 70s, he saw these huge number of young men, gay men, dying of this mysterious disease caused by HIV. And it was almost like he put on his armor and got on his horse and galloped right back into the battle. It was quite amazing. He was just energized by this terrible new epidemic. And it was interesting because many scientists kind of dismissed his efforts as kind of like, well, he's just an old man attempting to recapture his former glory. But initially, he played a very crucial role, kind of the role of Solomon, because there was a dispute between two star scientists, an American and a French, who both claimed they had discovered the AIDS virus. And it had gotten almost into an international incident, and the field was getting stifled because of this argument. And he played the role of Solomon, went back and forth, not asked by anyone, between the two, and had them come to an agreement of exactly what had happened. And so he really helped the field go forward. Now, most researchers, because this was a brand new virus and whatnot, really wanted to understand how HIV destroys the immune system before they could even think about therapeutic interventions. But Saul kind of charged forward, saying thousands are going to die for every year that we procrastinate. So he no longer had a laboratory, of course, at the Salk Institute, but he helped form a company called Immune Response and designed a treatment vaccine that would delay the time between infection with the virus and development of full-blown AIDS. And he first did a trial at the University of Southern California with Alexandra Levine, and I can't remember, 50 or 80 patients, I guess 82 patients, 60% who got the vaccine did get an improvement in their immune function and were able to clear the HIV, the virus, from their bloodstream. so he, again, he took a lot of flack for this. People said, well, you know, this is just crazy. You know, we really need to take the proper steps in the right order to have a vaccine. But he marched right ahead and was ready to start a very large national trial when he kind of reached an impasse with the FDA about the trial design. So kind of life had changed now. The rules had changed. He just couldn't do it at a Watson home for crippled children. Now, you know, he's talking about a national trial that the FDA was going to control. But he did have, I think, one of his most important roles in AIDS, in the whole AIDS saga, because he was kind of still a rock star by the public. He attracted the media and kind of helped move the field forward because he helped the public understand that AIDS wasn't about gay men. It was about a new disease in which they all had to deal, the public had to deal with. And so I think he did play an important important role there. And then finally he kind of came to agreement with the FDA and was just ready to start the trial when he died suddenly.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Yes. I am working on a biography or a story of a survivor of Hiroshima. Her name is Setsuko Nakamura, but then her married name is Thurlow. She's Canadian. And she was 13 years old and near the epicenter. And it's a study of initially of her surviving and, you know, what life was like prior to and after in Hiroshima and what all happened to her family. She, interestingly, spent the rest of her, many, they're called Hibakusha survivors. They don't like the word survivor. Were kind of embarrassed about it, would never say anything about it. She was one of the first to be very, very vocal about her experience, and she spent a good part of her life trying to warn about nuclear weapons, and in fact was one of the major people involved in the UN signing, getting so many countries to sign the anti-nuclear pact. She is called the heart and soul of ICANN, who just won the Nobel Peace Prize. And so she was the speaker at the Nobel Peace Prize in Stockholm a few weeks ago.
Wow.
And she's a fascinating woman with a fascinating tale. I'm departing from medicine, in a sense.
Well, I do look forward to reading that book, because it sounds like it will be every bit as interesting as your Salk biography. Charlotte, thanks very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you.